Thanks for listening to Bookworm. I'm host Michael Silverblatt. If there's another podcast that comes from us at KCRW that I really like, is The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell. I've said it for a long time. Elvis's style of interviewing is like jazz. He orchestrates so many interesting moments and gets people to say such surprising and interesting things about film, about popular culture. He really knows his subject, and he's one of the very best in the country. Listen to The Treatment.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I am happy to have Richard Ford as my guest. His new book is a book of four story version on novellas called Let Me Be Frank With You. It's the fourth of the books that feature Frank Bascom. And he has, in this book, invented a default self. And so when he says, let me be frank with you, he's performing Frank. Let me be frank with you. And it's a very interesting performance, and it's funnier than any of the other recent Bascom, because we know what he's thinking while he performs his default self. Yeah?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Nobody's ever said that before, and it's true.
So what were you doing? You were having a good time with him.
Oh, Christ, yes. I had such a good time, partly because I wasn't hauling around 200,000 words. That makes everything a lot happier. And then to write four stories that are 16,000 words apiece, that's pretty nice. But then this is something, I guess this is a book to some extent about getting older. And if you can't laugh at that, you're in dire straits.
Well, you are. In dire straits. I mean, I'm 62. And I read these books and I think, where were the books that told me, that warned me what was going to happen? This book is very good, both if you need to be warned and if you are old, if you need to be consoled. You will find consolation here and very, very useful tips. Frank's wife, Sally, tells him not to do the old guy walk, but instead to...
Yeah, pick his feet up.
And, since falling is such a problem for the soon-to-be elderly, let's say...
As Frank says, how far do these people fall when they fall? If people fall and they break everything, if they fall and they never recover, I don't know what it is about falling, but it seems to do people in.
And this is a one-on-one book in which Frank is giving us access to his thoughts while he's talking to a black woman who has come to visit his house. She lived there before he did, and she wants to see the place where a terrible thing happened.
Right. These stories are all about facing one kind of calamity or another. Ostensibly, it's the calamity of the Hurricane Sandy in 2012. But that's just sort of the umbrella for all of the other little minor calamities that everybody faces when they get older.
And Frank has attained the smoothness, let me say, of a brilliant talk show host. he manages to keep the people, he's interviewing the people he's talking to.
But he's also bearing witness. And part of what we do for others is that we give ourselves and our present to other people as they go through difficult situations. And that's one of the things he does. And his narration is somehow a buffer zone between himself and them.
Good old Frank Bascom, who we know from The Sports Writer, from Independence Day, from, of course, The Lay of the Land. Now, let me be frank with you. He seems to have, he's retired.
Yeah.
He's loosened up.
Yes.
He's not prone as much as he was in the lay of the land to subjective personal philosophy. He moves much more quickly, and his vehicle here is conversation.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's a much more, I think, enjoyable book to read. The Lay of the Land was still recuperating from the death of the child.
And prostate cancer.
Yes.
And the election of George Bush and 9/11 and all these kinds of other calamities. Yeah, those cast shadows throughout that long book. Indeed, they did.
And now he's kind of willing to be a clown.
A bit.
Not in private, in his interior, but in public, he's got a way about him. It is the way. He knows it now. He's not selling anything.
And his kids are gone. His kids are out of the house, not out of his hair.
And he can talk and use his good nature, that gift of gab, with people who he knows don't like him, really.
and who he really, in a way, doesn't like that much himself.
The man who bought the house Frank used to live in that the hurricane has blown down says he wants advice. Frank thinks he wants to shoot me.
Yeah, when he's sitting in his car at the shore, the Jersey Shore, he's afraid because the guy doesn't show up. He's afraid he's in the crosshairs of some guy's high-powered rifle. But, you know, you can't go through life these days, it seems to me, without thinking if you're someplace in public that somebody's going to shoot you. I mean, somebody's going to shoot somebody all the time in this country. Why should I, or why should you, or why should Frank feel that we're somehow immune from that? We're not. We're not immune from that. Happens all the time now. Why shouldn't it find its way into my stories?
The characters are talking. We're reading along. They're hilariously funny.
Oh, good.
The counterpoint between what a person says and what a person thinks makes the stories hilarious until they get to the point where it said, there's something I want to tell you.
Always.
And maybe I shouldn't tell you it, but I have something to tell you.
Yeah.
I slept with your wife.
Or my father killed my whole family in this house.
In this house, yeah.
Right. Or my house has been blown away by the hurricane.
Yeah. It's a kind of amazing thing because suddenly the tonality, what's being required of sociability, instantly changes.
Indeed.
And Frank has to pull out something more than his default self.
Right.
To deal with it.
That's when you have to bear witness. That's when your presence in the presence of another can't be denied. That's when whatever you have of empathy, whatever you have of developed sympathy for other people comes to the fore in a sense. And when you can't just be Frank, he can't be acting that role. He's what is asked of him is something that you really can't deny, either for another person or in yourself.
I'm talking to Richard Ford about his terrific, do you call it collection, assembly? What is it?
I call them stories. I just call them stories.
They're stories gathered together under the title, Let Me Be Frank With You. And I felt that I was having more fun with Frank than I'd had in years, that you somehow had rescued Frank from the pontificator he'd become in The Lay of the Land.
Well, I love The Lay of the Land, though, frankly speaking.
Oh, it's a wonderful book.
But I know exactly what you mean. It was a book. It was a book that was afflicted by, as his life was afflicted by, all kinds of things. You know, Wittgenstein says, you know, words of the world we live in, really. And so words, as he says someplace else, it's locution, locution, locution. Words are his defense against the world. Words are his environment. So you got a lot of them when there were a lot of troubles.
Well, it's also that Frank, in college, learned a lot of words.
Yeah.
He quotes Richard Hugo, if I'm not mistaken. He quotes Ben Jonson.
Yes, I saw
Ben Jonson there. He's an educated man coming out and striding, loping through uneducated times.
That's right.
And it's a very interesting thing. His brain is telling him the wisdom of poetry, and he knows it is still wisdom. Meanwhile, the world is throwing him images from poems. There's a roller coaster half submerged in the ocean as a result of Hurricane Sandy. And what could be a better poetic metaphor for America? You know, wanting to take the wild ride, and now it's drowning.
That's right. That's right. We all know stuff. We all have poems. If it's not poems, it's statistics. If we have all kinds of stuff filling our heads, and the real problem is to make something of that, to sort of use for others' benefits and for our own benefit all of the stuff that we know. And that's why Frank, who knows a lot of poetry, uses poetry to his benefit, often just to be funny.
Often to be funny, but also to, you know, if you're kind, you give a dog a bone to gnaw on.
Yeah.
Poetry is like the bone that Frank gives to people to have something to toy with, think over, chew on. It's good.
And not take too seriously either. Not take altogether seriously. You know, the Ben Jonson line that you noticed about language imitating the public riot. I mean, that's actually quite funny if you think about it, but it is also true.
And it's a great technique because it sneaks by like a joke that no one notices.
And you're not supposed to notice. It's just supposed to be there.
And we have to remember who Frank is. I mean, Frank tried to be a novelist.
Yes.
Frank was teaching literature while his dangerous friend, Teddy Medley, was sleeping with his wife.
Right.
Yeah.
As his marriage was coming apart in the 70s.
Yes, and we didn't know.
No.
I mean, it's such an incredible thing. We've just seen what Anne is like, Anne Dykstra, in the previous story. She is, you know, full of questions about her sexual meaningfulness.
Well, as Frank says, a lot of times people get old and their sexuality just begins to sort of wander around. And that's what has happened to Anne. Her sexuality, which has been committedly heterosexual before, has just gone a wander. And not even that it's found a home, but it's just not anywhere.
She's put up these pictures.
Yes.
Tell about these pictures.
Well, the pictures are
They're ostensibly pictures,
oil paintings of fruit, sliced open fruit, which Frank thinks look like vaginas. And so, which when he finally sees them, he's put them up just for him when he comes to visit. And so when he sees them, it completely undoes him for a while.
Yes, I mean, he feels aroused.
Yeah.
And when
unaccountably.
Yes. He can't explain it. This is his ex-wife. I mean, he no longer feels that way about her, and yet she's, in a sense, putting a display on.
Right.
She's chosen these pictures that say something about being available and about being open.
And about being old, in a sense, because she's the age she is, but her sexuality is on the march.
It's rampant.
Yes, it is.
Yes, and then we go with Frank in the next story to a man he hardly knows who wants to make a final confession. I F-bombed your wife. And that's how he says it. I F-bombed Anne.
Right.
You did? And then the...
My wife?
Yeah.
Why?
Why? Yes. It's an astounding conversation. It can't even be considered a spoiler because it's so innate. We're not spoiling anything.
Oh, no. You can give it all away if you want to. It should all just be in the reading, right? Should all be in the word choices.
Yeah, exactly. And it is so funny because Frank is still trying to be default Frank.
Yeah.
Calm, placid. My wife? You did?
Right.
Why? No, we weren't divorced yet. No, we were still married.
We have a word for that.
Right. Yeah. The default self is the way we would like to be seen so that we are the way we like to be seen, so that we actually inhabit that person who personifies the way we would like to be seen and liked and thought well of.
It's even, I think, a little more funny because it's not just the way we want to be seen, but the way we think other people want to see us.
And maybe even the way we are.
Yeah.
A lot of these Frank Bascom stories have led me on a long search about the notion of character and whether or not, as Emerson says, we have a mass within us somewhere, some kernel of some essence which we surround and which dictates to us how we are and how we behave. I've never quite found any evidence for that. So when I invent a notion like this, such as this, I'm just trying to account for the absence of character in ourselves, that we invent ourselves to be as much as we can a way we'd like to be. You know, Larkin said a wonderful thing. Larkin said a lot of wonderful things, Philip Larkin. He said that a poet who's giving a reading is me pretending to be me. And in a sense, that's what these stories are. Although I don't think there's much visible discrepancy between one me and the other, but you put your finger right on it with the title, Let Me Be Frank With You. Let Me Pretend To Be Frank With You, both frank and candid.
Yeah.
I had a lot of pushback on this title, and I thought to myself at the time, gee, what's wrong with you? This is the right title for this book. This book, but you are the only person who've actually put your finger on why it's the right title.
Well, it's interesting because I feel that because you've been with this character for three books, watched him divorce, watched him go through cancer, watched him go through the death of a child.
Yeah.
That question, who is he after all this happens? Who are we after our catastrophes?
Hello, that's exactly right. How does catastrophe in any way either change us or give us a perception of ourself that's more pure, that's more what it is?
That's beautiful. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Richard Ford about his new novel, Let Me Be Frank With You. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Richard Ford about his new book, Let Me Be Frank With You, a Frank Bascom book, a return to the story of the curmudgeonly Frank Bascom, now in his 60s and contemplating life after Hurricane Sandy. But isn't he in his 70s?
No, Richard's in his 70s.
Yeah, he's in his 70s.
Richard is. No, Frank's not.
Richard is, but Frank is not.
Frank's still behind me somewhere.
Richard, you're in your 70s.
Yeah, I am.
Now tell me, though, is the writing, the way in which you write, changing?
No,
No, I'm still doing it the same way I did ever since I wrote The Sports Writer, which is to say I spend a lot of time planning stuff. I spend a lot of time accumulating raw material for what I think will flesh out the book. And then I just study it and study it and study it and study it until I realize that I'm putting off writing by studying. And then I start to write something with my little pen like I always have.
Uh-huh.
You were talking about that earlier. I just write with a little ballpoint pen and type it up on a typewriter. Yeah.
Wow, that's great. No computer or
well,
does
eventually
a computer?
I type it on a computer so I can generate pages that I can then work. I don't edit on the computer. That's really where hell is when you edit on a computer, because when you edit things, it all looks right. Everything looks the way it's supposed to look.
I've never in the 25 years of the show asked a person how they write, but my friend and assistant promised me $100 I would ask that question. And I thought, well,
here's a sucker. Here's this
easy
guy.
Dough.
You know, he'll tell me.
Well, no, but I think it's great to know, because it is my feeling that in order to be written, something has to pass from the hand to the machine, the typewriter, to the computer page, and that tripling gives density to the broth. You know, you add things to the stew each time.
Absolutely. Every time you can make yourself go through something that you've written, it gets, in my life anyway, a little bit better. When you change a word in a sentence, somehow it refracts right through the whole paragraph, and then other things start to need to be looked at. And that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to preserve your interest in what you're doing, and you're trying to preserve your patience for what you're doing. And so all the ways that you can find, and doing things manually certainly multiplies these ways, all the ways that you can find to go back to your work, the better you're going to be.
Life and age seem to be the stern teachers in this book, that Hurricane Sandy destroying the northern shore of Jersey and creating a context of calamity, and then age bringing about inevitable senses of loss of what?
Well, I don't actually know loss of what. You inherit, as you get older, other people's lives, in a sense, and they tell you what aging is like. If you just look to yourself for the most part, you probably are better off. I didn't think that this was a book about aging, but maybe it is the case. I mean, I don't think aging from age 69 to 70 is any different from aging from 39 to 40. You're aging at the same rate, it seems to me. But as you get closer to the big D death, then I think maybe the whole issue becomes to be a little quickened in your own mind. But I don't think the experience of it, the literal experience of aging, has to be materially different from what it's always been, just because you're closer to dying.
You don't feel that you know more now?
I probably know more now, I know more now, but I'm probably not any smarter.
Yes, you know more now, but maybe you're not smarter. But surely I think that if you went back and wrote A Piece of My Heart now, or The Ultimate Good Luck, that age would change.
Oh, of course.
The way those books would come about.
Oh, of course. But that's all. That's just a kind of a tautology in a way. I mean, of course it would, but of course I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't essay to do that. At the time, you know, I love this notion of Francis Bacon's, the original Francis Bacon, that art is the daughter of time. And what that means to me is you write what you write when you write it, and you make it the best you can possibly make it, and then you go on and go on with the next thing that you might want to do. So that the thought that you would do something different many years later from how you did them the first time, yeah, you would, but you ain't going to do that. Yeats did, of course. Yeats went on revising his poems all of his life. But Richard's not going to do that. I'm even going to read him if I don't have to.
But Richard must know those characters better now. He doesn't have to rewrite the book. But the next time that kind of passion and foolery occurs, wouldn't it be richer and fuller, Richard?
Maybe. Well, but you know, though, Michael, when you write connected books with a single narrator, it isn't that you're dealing with a human being who actually has a past and who actually has the content that we all have in our lives, a memory. Frank doesn't have a memory. Frank is sort of like Charlie McCarthy. I put my hand in his back and make him do what he does. So I just have to make him up anew each time I bring him onto the scene. I don't have to worry about all the things that you and I would have to worry about with the next thing that we do. I mean, we worry, for instance, about whether or not we are being, consistent to who we think we are. I don't have to do that particularly with Frank. I just insist that he's consistent, and then he becomes consistent.
And he tells us that all he has is today and tomorrow.
That's right.
That's the whole of the venture.
Right. He has memory. He has what he does today. He has what he thinks he's going to do tomorrow and what he thinks about all of that. And that's basically what makes him up. And I control and conduct all of that. It's not like you and me.
But it still is, in a sense, like Rock Springs. You've got the character. Now let's send him a creep to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
They're not dangerous creeps the way they used to be, but they are, and sometimes creeps in the form of ex-wives.
Yes, they are.
The method, throw a spitball at the character in the form of a scary human being,
right,
is still going on, yeah?
I think that's a strategy most writers use. Bring something on to the stage, the outcome of which you do not know, and then make something happen with it so that implausibility or that unlikableness becomes something that is renewed.
Wow, Richard, it's really fun to talk to you. I've been talking with Richard Ford, author of Let Me Be Frank With You. It's published by Echo Press, which is a division of HarperCollins. It's very funny. It's a very enjoyable book. Thank you for joining
me. Great pleasure, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Listen, you can't avoid this program. It's everywhere. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez, and Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director today is Melissa Morton, sitting in for Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant, who owes me $100. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm, when Alain Mabankou is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.